Welcome to Delmarva Radio Theater, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. A robot is walking through the park. Names are important, but the robot has no name. It is cold, the temperature is dropping, and the snow is accumulating. The robot sits on a bench, his joints slowly freeze, and the whirring wheels of his artificial intelligence spin slower and slower until... Our drama today is Robot on a Park Bench, an original drama based on a short story by Brandon Getz that first appeared in the Delmarva Review, published by the Eastern Shore Writers Association. It was adapted for radio by your host. Our featured players for today's play are members of the Community Players of Salisbury and include Judy Hearn as the narrator, Robert Forrester as the robot, Tom Welch as the man in the park, and Angela Bird as the processing voice in the robot. Before we turn to our drama, we're pleased to have the story's author, Brandon Getz, with us today. Brandon, welcome to Delmarva Radio Theater. Brandon, let me ask you, first of all, how did you come to write Robot on a Park Bench? What is the genesis of this story?
The genesis would be twofold. One, I wanted to write a story originally that had two threads, and there were two protagonists, and it would jump between the two. And one was the bearded man with the dog, and the other was the robot. So I wrote that story, and it turned out that the bearded man was just terribly uninteresting, and the only interesting part was the robot. So I decided, okay, well, what if I just cut all of that other half of the story and just keep the robot and number the sections and see how that works out. And it turned out to work a lot better with a few revisions. The other thing was that I wanted to give a nod to Spokane, Washington, where I did my grad school work. And so the setting, the park there, is a nod to that town.
Well, how did it come about, though, that you wanted to write about a robot?
I've always been a sci-fi nerd, always been into spaceships and robots and those sorts of things. But we see a lot of robots in science fictional stories, but I wondered how would that trope work if you brought them into a very typical kind of literary setting. You know, there aren't laser beams and starships in this story. It's very quiet. It's just the turning of the seasons in a park. And so I wanted to explore this character that we see in some pretty typical settings moved into a different setting, and how would he react there?
Brandon, your other writings, have you focused on science fiction in your other writing?
I've jumped. I began when I was very young writing science fiction stuff, and then I moved toward the very literary, and then it was things like Robot on a Park Bench, where I was writing literary stories but taking an element from genre, whether it's a robot or a demon or a ghost, and putting them in the sort of traditional literary story context, the small, quiet stories. And then more recently, I've been getting into full-fledged, pulpy science fiction, just to see how that goes. But I really enjoy doing both, trying to flex my literary chops and also just getting into the fun of laser guns and people in space.
That sounds like fairly light fare in one sense, Brandon.
Sure.
But what impresses me about Robot on a Park Bench is that this is much more than a story about a robot. There's some real depth to this story. And what does this robot symbolize for you?
I would guess it's a reckoning, seeing and understanding mortality, which it took until my late 20s to begin to even process that I was not going to live forever. And then the robot is a step further in that, in not only understanding mortality, but taking that into your own hands. And the robot takes it into his own hands, ceases to function. I wouldn't advocate that, but I think that there's something about just knowing that your life is under your control, and recognizing how finite that is, but what a great power that is, that's yours to do with as you will.
One of the aspects of the robot in your story is that the robot senses himself becoming obsolete. And was that in your mind as you looked at the decline of the robot in your story?
I think that's a fear that I have. I don't think that I'm there yet, but that at a certain point, that I will be replaced by the newer and better thing. I already see my brother, who's 13 years younger than me, the way that he interacts with the world, the way that he interacts with technology, those sorts of things, even though we're still sort of the same generation, he is much more comfortable in the new world of smartphones and such than I am. And I feel like that's just going to keep getting exponentially more difficult to navigate.
One of the aspects of the robot in the robot's decline is that as the robot becomes obsolete, Brandon, the robot is marginalized. And I like the word marginalized because he's gradually shunted aside. Did you have any sense of that for the robot when you wrote this piece about being set aside, as it were?
Well, I wanted to explain why he's so free to go on these walks, to feed the cats, and so it was sort of a logical conclusion that if this robot is created by these scientists, he would have been created for some function, but if he's no longer needed for that function, they're not going to get rid of him, but he's going to just sort of be sitting around. And so I wanted to explain that in some way, but I really liked how it developed, where his marginalization and his inability to connect with the new generations of the robots, or to even be of any use to his creators, actually does end up in creating his freedom. The more useful he would have been, the less free he would be to explore and do the things that he seems to care about doing.
Brandon, it's a wonderful story. And we're all indebted to you for writing Robot on a Park Bench for us.
And thank you so much.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on the program as well. Thank you. And now for our drama, Robot on a Park Bench.
The robot's knees had rusted in the autumn rains. He lifted each leg, exercising the oxidation out of the joints. According to his barometric sensors, there would be precipitation within the hour. More complications for his joints. A silicon frame like the one the facility gave to newer models might have been preferable, lightweight and unrustable. Everything has its flaws. In any case, he hadn't been given the choice. As he walked through the park, his square, heavy feet sunk into the earth. Dirt clotted in their ridges of tread. He would have to dig out later before re-entering the facility. A man was sleeping on one of the benches. The robot couldn't feel cold. A slowness in his metal body, maybe, but not the chill, though he knew the park was cold. His temperature gauges read 0.6 centigrade. Factoring the man's approximate age, weight, the alcohol content level on his sleeping breath, and the relative thickness of his camouflage blanket, and assuming temperatures and all other variables remained constant, the man did not wake up, no one added a thicker blanket, the robot calculated that the man would be dead in 5 hours. With his joints squeaking and grinding as they were, the robot was sure the man would wake, but he only stirred and shifted onto his side, giving himself another 15 to 17 minutes approximately to live. By the time he reached the carousel, the robot was tired. He had been tired, in fact, for a very long time. Perhaps he had been programmed tired. There were no recorded dates in his memory banks that were not tinged with some degree of weariness, some exhaustion with the world and his role in it, though what that role was he still did not seem to know. The carousel's lights and music were off, and a heavy green tarpaulin had been hung from hooks in its ornamental roof to shelter the wooden animals from winter. Beyond the carousel, the river trickled toward the water power dam, the falls, and after.
Processing. Processing.
825.06 kilometers of lakes and reservoirs and dams, the ocean. The robot stomped his treaded feet on the sidewalk, but the dirt stuck. His knees were stiff. The barometer was dropping. He settled onto a bench up from the bank from the river, where two small birds wrestled over a lollipop stick. The birds' movements were so quick, they seemed incomplete, unfluid, as if from a film that was missing essential frames. The birds hopped from moment to moment on their lithe, brittle legs, the stick like a thread between them. When the first snowflake fell on the park, it settled on the robot's heavy bolted jaw and froze in place. By then, the park seemed almost empty. The dying homeless man, an old woman dragging a little flat-faced dog, a jogger in gray sweats with white wires in her ears. Across the river, two park workers were raking leaves into big black bags. A young man with a beard walked his bearded dog past them and onto the footbridge. The bearded man and the bearded dog. Somewhere in the banks of the robot's circuitry played an old television laugh track. The two bearded animals turned toward the river, the smaller beast sniffing loose duck feathers on the concrete. They passed the robot without realizing he was there. He was part of the landscape.
Please, sir, ask your dog not to urinate on my foot.
The man nearly jumped out of his skin.
Processing. Jumped out of his skin. An idiom appropriate for the sensation of fright, surprise.
The robot had been integrating the idioms he overheard in the facility, and he prized his ability to use them in context.
I have problems with rust. It is not pleasant.
Sorry. Come here, boy.
The man jerked the leash, and the dog, already finished, wiggled off toward a garbage can to sniff.
I'm sorry about that. I didn't see you.
The robot tilted its skinny bucket head and shook the pee off its leg.
It's all right.
The robot's voice played like a vinyl recording from a speaker in its mouth, and when it spoke, it opened its jaws wide to project the sound.
I have problems with rust. There are problems with my joints. The bolts, you see.
Is this a joke?
What is a joke?
Am I on camera?
I'm sorry.
Processing. Processing.
That does not correspond with my definition of joke.
The robot's mouth opened again. This time, the laugh track played through the speaker in its throat.
My data suggests that it's appropriate to express amusement when another is expressing amusement.
Your data is probably right. This snow might be a problem, too, for your joints. It's really coming down.
The robot noticed a car pass the park without its headlights on. It shrunk into the white horizon, its back lights flashing briefly red before it turned a corner, away from the river. Snow was settling on the robot's arms and legs. It fell in spirals over the river and the carousel and the other benches lining the sidewalks. It was collecting now, thin sheets and clumps of white over the whole park, the city. He picked one snowflake out of the millions and followed its arc into the icy surface of the river.
I like the river. Do you watch it much?
Do I what?
Is this grammar not correct? My data assures me this verb is correct.
No, it's fine. I don't usually go around watching rivers. It's cold.
-0.7 centigrade.
Right.
The robot gestured toward the water. The articulate fingers and wrist whirred with the working of gears.
Can you see that?
See what?
A bird is dying.
I don't see anything.
The man with the dog asked him where he was from and was he lost. The robot wasn't lost. He had a GPS uplink in his chest. The engineers and technicians, if they had use for him, would page his uplink and convey the exact coordinates of the next intelligence test or hardware upgrade or military demonstration. Increasingly, because of the newer models, the more human-looking prototypes with their moving latex faces and silicon frames, they did not have a use for him. For now, he was just taking a walk. He'd been taking walks for months, each one a little further from the facility. From the satellite maps, he had known a river ran nearby, a runoff from the mountains, with a big, rocky falls at the heart of the city. He was watching the river now, the river and the people and the snow, the world with all its moving parts.
The snow is pleasant.
I guess so.
In the storage facility, two striped cats caught the mice that escaped from the laboratory cages, and when the mice were gone, it was the robot's job to feed them tuna from cans he held in his palm. The technicians had named them George and Gracie, though they were both females, the robot discovered, and he had secretly taken to calling the other Georgia. He liked that, having a secret. He liked learning that he could keep secrets. He could feel the snow's weight now. The mean temperature of his body had lowered, though the networks of circuit boards throughout his head and abdomen running at safe temperatures. He calculated that if he did not move from the bench, and if all other variables remained constant, his functions would begin to slow in less than 2 hours. He didn't think he would mind. The river was still moving. The man and the dog were still there. As long as he wasn't asked directly, that was it. The technicians and the engineers never asked by what name he called the smaller cat. He was not compelled to tell them. They did not ask where he went when he wasn't in the storage room, or why he never associated with the new models. When they did ask about the rusk, he said it had developed from the oxidation process that resulted from the chemical fusion of water and iron. Technically, that had been a factual response. The robot calculated that as long as he was never asked directly, he could keep a secret indefinitely.
My girlfriend's going to wonder where I am. The dog's getting cold.
Yes. The dog will die in 3.2 hours if variables remain constant.
Right. I don't want him to do that.
That would be unpleasant.
The robot leaned forward to pet the bearded dog. The dog made a sound of fright and bit the robot's flat steel hand. This, it seemed, caused the dog more confusion than pain.
He doesn't like strangers much. He's starting to go blind.
If only he could be upgraded.
Right. Don't stay too long.
How long is too long?
Long enough to freeze, I guess. To cause frostbite or whatever, rust.
Yes, that would be too long.
On the telephone poles outside the park, there were no missing robot flyers. Cars rolled through downtown, churning dirt and gravel through the new snow. The man and the dog trudged through drifts of white towards home. Snowflakes continued their analog whirl, falling faintly and faintly falling upon all, the living and the digital. The robot's sensors noted the darkening of the sky over the park. They measured spectroscopics and luminoscopics and the gradual shutdown of the robot's own secondary functions. Data relayed from chip to chip in whatever network of copper and silica comprised the robot's consciousness. Now, under thick clumps of wet snow, he did not bother to move his limbs, and anyway the joints had been frozen for an hour. He watched the river move until it was too dark to see, or until his optics ceased to operate. He did not know which. He listened to the water until his oral sensors froze over. The temperature kept dropping. He sat on the bench in the darkness of himself and waited for the last of his primary functions to cease, for the moment when he would no longer be aware of moments. Who would feed Georgia and Gracie? The little cans of tuna on the floor of the storeroom? Who would open them if not him? That had been his job. A job is a kind of purpose, a reason to exist, however small. He thought of the cats mewing for their food, licking the juice from the cans off his hand. And he thought of them without him, ceasing to function, the movement of their breathing stopping quietly in some corner of the lab. Even cats die alone. What happens then? That is the secret everything keeps. Long after he could perceive it, the dark river reflected on the flat discs of his eyes. Primary motor systems ceased. Even if he'd wanted to, he could not move his limbs. Remaining power diverted to memory banks, to cognition.
Processing.
Gradually, memory began to fade. Hard drives froze in succession. The man and his dog were the first to be forgotten. Then the behavioral programs, the voice modulator. He forgot to worry about the cats or the rust in his knees. He forgot what a knee was. As the snow stopped falling, the last of his memory discs spun on its tiny wheels. The secret names of the cats, the walks he'd taken along the river, the way home.
Processing. Error.
What is cat?
Error.
What is river?
Error.
What is home?
Thank you for listening to Delmarva Radio Theater. We'll be back with a new play based on an original story by Margaret Rodenberg, Mrs. Morissette. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.